Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Julie and Julia, the new Nora Ephron film that's being released this week. I'm here with Kathleen Collins. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Dana.
Who is the author of Watching What We Eat, The Evolution of Television Cooking Shows, a book that came out this year about the history of cooking on TV. So, perfect podcast companion for this movie. First of all, Kathleen, did you like the movie?
I loved it. I'm still glowing.
Same here. I absolutely loved it. Just finished gushing about it in the Slate Culture Gab Fest. So I'm going to try to use your expertise here to do something besides just sort of coo over what a fun movie it is to watch. But do you want to just briefly talk about, well, if you want, you can sort of briefly outline the story of the film.
All right. Well, gushing aside, the movie's based on two books, the Julie and Julia by Julie Powell, the blogger who became a book author based on her attempt to, well, her successful attempt to make all of the recipes in Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Julia Child's classic, she co-authored her classic French cookbook, and she attempted to make all the recipes in that cookbook over the course of 1 year. The other book that it's based on is My Life in France, that is Julia Child's, basically her memoir, written with her grandnephew, Alex Prudhomme. So Nora Ephron wove these two stories together.
And successfully so, do you think?
I think it was very, very well done.
So did the structure work for you? We were talking in the Gabfest about whether this parallel structure where the two people never meet, which actually I'm just realizing now is the same as Sleepless in Seattle, the Nora Ephron film, right? That there's
That's
these
true.
Sort of two characters who only converge at the very end. In this movie, they never converge. Mm-hmm. Did you agree with this, you know, sort of, I've been hearing some sort of ambient criticism about this movie that the Julia part with Meryl Streep is much stronger than the Julie part with Amy Adams?
I have to admit, no criticism of the Julie part, but I would have been perfectly happy and satisfied with just the Julia Child part because I just adore Meryl Streep and Julia Child, and I think that part was really a story in and of itself. But I think it was a nice blend, and it made sense to weave these two stories.
It would have been an entirely different, it would have been a biopic of Julia Child, right? And a completely different theme.
Definitely. It's a nice story to put these two things together. But to say that the Julia Child part is stronger, it's hard for me to be objective. I mean, it felt stronger to me because I was just more drawn to it. I was more excited when those scenes came on the screen. But I thoroughly enjoyed the other. I keep wanting to say the Amy parts, but I may slip into calling the Amy and the Julia parts. But Amy Adams is the actress who plays Julie Powell. So I don't know. Are people criticizing the
Well, I haven't actually read any of this stuff yet, but I have a feeling, I mean, just sort of, I guess even in the screening last night, I could feel the Rotten Tomatoes page in my mind, you know, what the criticism of the movie would be, although I don't share it. I can see where it would come from, which is, for one thing, that this is one of those movies that has basically no conflict in it, that every once in a while some obstacle is thrown in the lady's path, but basically it's sort of, you know, a very happy self-empowerment story about two people, you know, changing their careers and their lives by learning how to cook. And you know, I can certainly see that makes it the feel-good movie of the summer, but not necessarily so well dramatically structured. I mean, you don't really care when you're sitting in the movie if you enjoy food and those two performances, but I think that would be where it would go.
Right. I guess so. I mean, again, it's impossible for me to be objective in that way because I do love food. And I actually, having read both of those books, you know that there are conflicts in those lives that are just sort of shined up and glossed over in a Nora Ephron way, in a nice way. But yeah, it's sort of a very happy.
Yeah, I mean, Nora Ephron is not Kierkegaard. Like, we're not talking, this is not deep thinking which is brought to the movie.
And in fact, it never occurred to me until last night that Amy Adams actually reminds me of Meg Ryan a lot. Did you ever think of that?
Oh, I didn't even think of that. I always sort of think of her as our generation's Julie Andrews.
Oh,
who
she does
I like
have
a lot
that
better
look.
Than Meg Ryan.
Yeah.
But it's certainly true that the kind of casting, you know, choices that she's made are putting her in a very Meg Ryan kind of mold, which hopefully doesn't become a hole that she can't dig her way out of.
No, that's what I was thinking about, because I do think she's more less Cupie doll, you know, more natural.
Well, I guess it was after seeing her in Enchanted that I started to put her in my mind in a kind of Julie Andrews. I mean, I wouldn't elevate her to that status because I worship Julie Andrews, but she can sing. I think of her as a sort of all-around show person, maybe a little bit more than Meg Ryan, who really just had the cuteness thing going for her.
Right.
But that said, I mean, poor Amy Adams, right? She has a lot of charisma. I think she's a really terrific, promising performer. I'm actually really excited that her career is taking off because I've been wanting it to, you know, since I first saw her in movies, but... Mm-hmm. To act in this movie opposite, not quite opposite, but sharing the screen, sort of alternating the screen with Meryl Streep is just, it's a hopeless task.
Right,
because,
right.
I mean, especially at this point in her career, Meryl has just become this kind of bomb of charisma.
Right.
And she just, it's not that she sucks the rest of the movie in because she's a generous performer,
right.
but you just can't wait for her to get back on screen.
But you're right about her generosity. I mean, I didn't feel this... this like slap in the face when we switched from Julia to Amy scenes or anything. It felt okay to me. But like I said, it was those Julia scenes. I just couldn't wait to get back to her. Meryl Streep is so luminous, and she is in every single role that she plays. And I have to say, the voice was just, I know I shouldn't dwell on such an obvious comment, but she just did the voice so well. I was trying to imagine another performer doing that, and I could imagine it feeling like an overlaid, trying too hard voice.
Well, it's a really extreme voice.
Yeah.
I mean, even as she does it, and I mean, I imagine that Julia Child didn't only talk that way on TV and that she actually talked that way in her personal life, but it is an incredibly strange style of speaking.
Yeah, and she just pulled it off. It seemed very, very natural to me. It didn't seem, you know, you weren't just aware of it all the time that she's doing this voice. It's just she inhabited it very smoothly.
Because this is such a gynocentric movie, it's basically all about sort of female self-discovery and self-empowerment. It would be very easy for the men to, as they often do in girl movies, be these kind of cliched obstacles or also cliched supportive husbands. In fact, they are both very supportive husbands, both the men in the movie, who we should mention is Chris Messina plays Amy Adams' husband in the present day, and Stanley Tucci plays Paul Child, Julia Child's husband, who was a diplomat stationed all around the world for a while in Paris, which is where she learned to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought both of those male characters were just great, too.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really loved the way Stanley Tucci played that part, in particular, with this sort of very wry, kind of detached amusement at his kind of, you know, sort of living tornado of a wife.
Right. And from everything I've read about their marriage, he seemed to capture that perfectly. He was just behind her all the way.
You don't see that many portraits of happy marriages on screen that aren't boring, and their marriage seemed really fun. I particularly loved that, not just implication, but basically the fact that they had sex all the time, right? And there's this great moment that you hear her in voice over writing a letter to a friend and saying, and we have our lunch, and then Paul has his nap in the afternoon, and while you hear her saying Paul has his nap, you see them tearing at each other's clothes.
No, we do, you know, we do this and we do that. We do other things, right. I have to say my favorite scene was right in the very first few minutes when they were eating the famous sole meuniere in that restaurant when they first arrived in France, and she took a bite of it and then fed him a bite, and they had that sputtering, they couldn't find the words
right,
to
completely
describe.
Nonverbal reaction.
Yeah,
to the
and
dish.
I have to say it was very emotional to me because that story, when you read in her memoir, My Life in France, she describes that scene, and that whole restaurant experience is often touted as her life-changing experience, and when she sort of began the rest of her life. And so to see that on screen was like a great moment for me, and the way that they dealt with it, with that reaction, you could just see their marriage in that little tiny moment, and I just thought it was beautiful.
Yeah, it starts off the movie very strong because
right.
you already have a sense of those two characters just from that sort of wordless moment of sputtering.
Right, and it was humorous, too. I mean, it got us in that sort of spirit of her personality right away.
Now, if I were going to have any criticism of the movie, I think it would have to do with the other husband character, the Chris Messina character.
Yeah.
Not because of Chris Messina. I actually think he's adorable, and he's great in the part. But I think that Efren's writing is a little bit weaker in that part. And essentially, the only way she has of creating some conflict in the Julie scenes is to throw in these odd fights where she and her husband suddenly, you know, get upset and are basically throwing crockery about something, and he storms out.
Yeah, he didn't. Same with me. I had the exact same reaction. I just didn't really like him that much, and in her book, in Julie's book, he seemed like more of a gentle creature to me, and he seemed a little bit rougher or more a smattering of Neanderthalism coming
actually,
out.
Actually, you see, I really did like him, and I guess if he was a Neanderthal, he was my kind of Neanderthal. But he sort of reminded me of the Miranda's husband on Sex and the City, except with more sex appeal, like that guy with more sex appeal.
Yeah.
But no, I thought just the problem was that there was this ongoing thread of this idea that she was the blog was sort of taking over her life, and essentially she was becoming kind of a jerk who was mistreating him, and those moments were just seemed very hastily tacked onto the movie. In fact, she was basically a sweetheart all the time.
Right.
Who would suddenly become a bitch for one scene in order for there to be a fight.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that's probably something that, again, if you read the book, you have all this prior knowledge and you interpret those things differently. So to me, I remembered, they weren't having enough sex and that really bothered him and she felt guilty about it. But that scene in the bar when she was with her friends lamenting the fact that she turned into a bitch didn't seem warranted. She did not seem like a bitch to me.
Right. And her friend actually agrees with her. Her friend, by the way, played by the great Mary Lynn Rushkub, or however you say her last name from 24. I never get tired of that.
Oh, okay, because I didn't recognize her. I've never seen 24, but she was wonderful.
Well, she's often the go-to Gal Friday best friend type.
Very
in
realistic.
Movies as well. Yeah, she's great. All right, let's take a brief break and talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, which is the premier purveyor of audiobooks on the web. And as regular listeners know, we have a deal with Audible where if you sign up through our page, which is www.audiblepodcast.com/spoiler, you can get a month-long membership and you get a free book with that. So even if you decide not to keep your membership, you get to keep your book. And we have a great recommendation actually this week because it turns out that Julia Child's memoir that we were just talking about, My Life in France, is on Audible, read by a woman named Kim Farrell. And so if you want to get on Audible and download it, they have abridged and unabridged versions, I believe. And you can hear the Sol Meunier story from the first person.
Right.
Okay, so I wanted to have one sort of peg to the current day because I think this movie, I think it's pretty obvious that this movie will be a big summer hit.
Right.
It both has tremendous audience appeal and it also seems very linked to our current concern, obsession in the U.S. with food, mm-hmm. with cooking shows, with, sort of, the locavore movement, with, all these sort of new trends in foodieism. And I wanted to hear what you had to say about that because in an odd way, I mean, it connects into that, that set of trends, but then it doesn't at the same time because the world of cuisine, Julia Child's world of cuisine, is a very mid-20th century one that's very different from sort of what's going on now.
I think that I've heard people say this, and I'm not inventing the idea, that Julia Child is sort of, she's timeless because she always just used real ingredients and didn't have any kind of mantra about how you should eat. You should just eat well. And we've been through a few decades of you should eat this way, you should not eat this, you should eat this. And I feel like a little bit of a backlash has prevailed, and people are often hearkening back to Julia. Julia just said, eat whatever you want and eat in moderation and enjoy everything. So she's sort of like this touchstone for just normal, sensible living.
Although the diet that Amy Adams' character has in the year that she cooks every recipe from Mastering the Art of French Cooking must have been the most unhealthful year of her life.
The buttery year of her life, yeah.
Scene after scene, you just see her making duck and boeuf bourguignon and chocolate cream pie. And
right.
It looks absolutely great. There's sort of this ongoing joke that she and her husband gain all this weight during that year, but of course they still look like movie stars throughout the entire year.
Right. They weren't willing to do the Jake LaMotta diet.
I will say, though, that Meryl Streep really does sort of chub up. I don't think it was, I think it was mostly padding, probably.
Yeah.
But
it was
she's a big woman.
Just a side note on that. Those scenes of her from behind, when her sort of like her butt looks big, they just looked like you could imagine that was Julia, very tall at her counter and sort of bent over too much and her butt sticking up in the air. It looked so good.
Yeah, between Meryl Streep's gait and the costuming and whatever padding they did and the fact that apparently they cast all short people around her so that she would look taller, it's really, really effective. And she has this kind of lurching, huge quality.
Mm-hmm. I can't. She's only 5'6", I read. Meryl Streep is only 5'6".
Oh, and they had to make her look 6 feet tall. Nicely done.
Yeah.
So as the author of this history of television cooking shows, you just contributed something to the New York Times Magazine to go along with that Michael Pollan piece about right. cooking shows and about the subsequent decline of cooking in the U.S.
Right.
You made this interactive timeline that was sort of a history of cooking shows from radio days all the way up to the present. And mm-hmm. I wanted you to talk about we'll put a link to that on our page. And I wanted you to talk about how Julia Child fits into that. I mean, obviously, she's this huge seminal figure, but she wasn't the first cooking personality right. on TV. Do you want to talk about, you could either talk about some of her predecessors or just what it was that made such a splash in 1963 when right. her show premiered?
She was not the first television cooking show host, but she was the first that many people remember, the first that many people ever saw. And she was really the first of kind of the, entertaining cooking shows.
Did her show air in prime time?
Yes, it did, and it was on public television. It aired on prime time at some point, I think, but it aired at different times all the time. So, I mean, when I was watching it when I was little, it was probably on repeats, and it was, I don't know, some morning. There was a television cooking show host named Dione Lucas who was on the air on commercial television starting in 1947.
Oh, the very early days.
Yeah,
of TV.
I mean, James Beard was the first TV cooking show host in 46. Dione followed him a year later. And she did French cooking. She went to the Cordon Bleu also and was very, very skilled. And she was a restaurateur and cookbook author and a teacher. And she was on the air for over a decade. And Julia Child refers to her as the mother of French cooking in America. She brought it to television, but she just didn't have the following, and that was partially because maybe French cooking wasn't de rigueur in 1947 the way it was in the early 60s, and people didn't have TVs in 1947, and there's a lot of reasons. And also, she just didn't have the personality. She had a very witty, dry kind of very European kind of prissy personality.
Right. But like understated, which is everything
yes,
that Julia Child was not.
Yes. And so people, you know, she had a following, she had loyal watchers, but not the grand following that Julia got. Julia was popular immediately when she came on the air. So it was a combination of the timing and her personality that just made that show what it was and made her so lasting in our popular culture. I mean, look at her now. I mean, it's whatever year it is, and she's still you know, in the limelight. It's
right,
amazing.
And she's still a personality that someone like me, who probably didn't ever see her show as a child, that I remember. I mean, she's just in parodies or whatever, in clips.
Everybody knows her. Yeah.
So do you share Michael Pollan's sadness that he expresses in that article and the sort of decline of the cooking show and the decline of home cooking? Or are you more sanguine about the future?
I am more optimistic than he is. I mean, he understands the complexity of why we cook less. You know, that's what his article is all about. Many, many different reasons go into that. I think one of the things that he's saying, and other people have said this, is that cooking shows have caused people to leave the kitchen. I may be overstating his argument, but it's in there somewhere. There's sort of that blame. I just don't agree with that at all. I don't think that the exciting, sexy TV shows have lured people away from the kitchen. If people like to cook, they're not going to stop cooking because they're watching the Food Network. And in fact, just the opposite. I do believe that the Food Network shows, as much as they are not as explicitly teaching us as they used to be, still do inspire people, give people ideas, and do teach people on a smaller scale. And I think there's a lot of good to be got. I think they're a force for good. I mean, they're huge marketing meccas, but I still think they're generally for the good.
I hope this movie becomes a culinary force for the good and that it leads to a season of many rich and indigestible French dinner parties.
Wonderful.
Thanks for joining me on this Slate spoiler special, Kathleen.
Thanks, Dana.
Our producer is Wynn Rosenfeld. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.